Support for West Virginia Public Broadcasting is provided by CAMC Urology, specializing in detection and treatment of prostate cancer. More information at camc.org/beatprostatecancer. And by Sears Monument Company, the art of remembering, producing and installing monuments in West Virginia, southeastern Ohio, and western Kentucky. More at searsmonument.com.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from T. Rowe Price, offering a strategic investing approach that examines investment opportunities firsthand. Institutions, advisors, employers, and individuals choose T. Rowe Price. T. Rowe Price. Invest with confidence. And from DXC Technology, designing and deploying global digital solutions that integrate with a client's mainstream IT. Learn more at dxc.technology. DXC Technology. Thrive on change.
It's 7:43 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Teresa Wills. Schools across the state are closed this morning. Some lawmakers are blaming unions.
The union leaders pulled the trigger on a strike before the bill even passed. Now, what is that? I mean, that should in itself be, prima facie evidence that they're not genuine negotiators here.
That's just ahead. Stay with us. This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. Leaders of West Virginia Teacher and School Service Personnel Unions have announced a statewide strike will begin today. Public schools are closed across 54 of the state's 55 counties, with Putnam County remaining open. As Dave Mistich reports, the announcement of a strike came just before the state Senate cleared the latest version of a long, sweeping, and controversial education reform bill.
The nearly statewide strike will be the second set of walkouts in as many years. In February of last year, West Virginia teachers went on strike demanding better pay and benefits. The 2018 walkouts lasted 9 school days. This time around, teachers and school employees aren't as interested in increased pay as they are opposed to a comprehensive education reform package known as Senate Bill 451. Representatives of three unions made the announcement outside the Senate before the upper chamber adopted the latest version of the bill. American Federation of Teachers West Virginia President Fred Albert says the decision to strike was motivated by Monday's movement on the measure.
That we want the process to work. We want the House to take their time like they've done before, but we're not leaving anything to chance, and we're not waiting a day longer.
Within an hour of the announced strike, county administrators began calling off school. As it stands after debate in the Senate on Monday, Senate Bill 451 ties pay raises to components opposed by teachers. Among the proposed reforms, the bill would allow up to 7 charter schools to be established in the state in coming years. It would also create up to 1,000 education savings accounts for parents of students with special needs. The House's proposal had capped charter schools at 2 pilots and had removed education savings accounts from the measure entirely. Other changes exist in the latest version of the bill. Senate President Mitch Carmichael celebrated the newest version of the measure. He also took aim at the leaders of unions calling for the strike.
The union leaders pulled the trigger on a strike before the bill even passed. Now, what is that? I mean, that should in itself be, prima facie evidence that they're not genuine negotiators here. They're not at the table doing the things that they need to do.
The House of Delegates is set to gavel in at 11 a.m. Tuesday to consider the Senate's latest changes to Senate Bill 451. The House could concur with the Senate version or reject the bill and send it to a conference committee, where members would hash out the differences between the two chambers. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Dave Mistich in Charleston.
On last night's episode of The Legislature Today, host Suzanne Higgins spoke with Delegate Matthew Rohrbach, chairman of the Senate the Select Committee on Prevention and Treatment of Substance Abuse, and minority chairman Delegate Andrew Robinson. This committee is new, and it aims to tackle the state's struggle with opioid addiction. In this excerpt, we hear about a variety of bills passed out of the committee and moving through the legislative process.
What do you think is the most significant, the most impactful piece of legislation that got through your committee this session?
Wow. Can I give you several? Yeah. I think sober living spaces. I think expansion of medical assisted treatment.
Let's just talk about sober living spaces. You know, with the stigma, with everything that the misconceptions that people have with sober living spaces, it's often you will find in that community, not in my neighborhood. So what does the bill do, and you know, how do you address that kind of attitude still?
Well, what the bill does is it takes into account that under federal Fair Housing Act law, we cannot discriminate against people with substance abuse. So a lot of city and county ordinances can't apply. What these spaces do is they say, okay, if you want to comply, then you can get state and federal funding. If you don't want to comply, then you don't. We don't want to shut sober living spaces down, but we want them safe. I don't want 20 people in a 3-bedroom house as we have in some parts of this state. I want spaces that are hygienic and safe for occupancy for people that are undergoing sober living type treatment arrangements.
Do you think this will encourage more sober living homes? Because we know that within the community, folks that are working in treatment and recovery will tell you there are not enough of these spaces.
I think when you put some funding behind it, it usually does have the effect of encouraging people to play by the rules. So these are new rules that hopefully will create an avenue for people to get funding, but they're going to have to do it the right way.
Delegate Robinson, I want to move this as quickly through as many of the different approaches that you're taking in terms of expanding access and treatment. One of the bills, an important bill that got through the House, is the Family Drug Court Program. Tell us briefly what that does.
Well, I think we all are somewhat familiar with how the drug courts are participating now, and we were lucky enough to have Judge Thompson come in and speak to us and talk about some implementation of a family drug court that would do the same kind of process, but for abuse and neglect cases would allow them to do a family drug court, which would implement all aspects of the family. He said that he had instances where he was talking to a juvenile and the parent was on the front steps, ODing on the steps of the courthouse. So this will allow him to bring in the entire family and work with them as a whole and try to improve the whole family dynamic while improving that for the juvenile and the adult.
And that is over in the Senate right now. It's passed the House. It's in the Senate. A couple other drug court related bills, or at least, you know, services that are offered. I wanted to go through House Bill 3133, requiring parolees and probationers found to have suffered with addiction to participate in support services, and then requiring participation in drug court program before the discharge of certain first-time drug offenses. That's Senate Bill 62. Also, really important follow-up services, Mr.
Well,
Chairman.
We've focused on four things as our committee: prevention, treatment, harm reduction, and then the judicial aspect. And I do think that the two bills you just referenced more are in the judicial realm, but it's an attempt to say we want your treatment to be meaningful. That if you want to get expungement, if you want to get a clean record, you're going to have to go through certain avenues of treatment to get there. So I think the day when we just don't follow up on people is over with. We want the courts to follow up, and we want, at the other end of treatment, a productive, tax-paying citizen.
Delegate Robinson, another really important bill that is in your committee, was in your committee, House Bill 3132, Medication-Assisted Treatment Access. Can either one of you speak to that?
I think Dr. Rohrbach.
Well, I'll gladly speak to that. That bill is really going to allow the expansion of medical assisted treatment. What we hear over and over, and I'm a practicing physician, so I'm fairly well equipped with my medical friends. I don't do medical assisted treatment, but what we hear over and over are doctors in rural communities They don't want to fool with the paperwork to be a treatment center, but they say, you know, I've got 20, 30 people here in my community that I would like to treat. Those people would like to get treated in their communities rather than to have a drive of an hour or an hour and a half to Beckley or to Charleston or to Huntington. So this is an attempt to get local doctors to treat people. And it also, if you can get things local, you're more apt to do it. Just pure and simple.
It's going to be easier for a patient to go to a doctor that they, you know, have a familiarity with, a connection with, and there's more confidentiality.
There's no doubt about it that will help. And that's what we hear over and over from our rural doctors.
That was Delegate Andrew Robinson and Delegate Matthew Rohrbach speaking with host Suzanne Higgins on the legislature today. To hear the full interview, visit our website, wvpublic.org. This morning, we begin a new health series that focuses on issues facing elderly residents in West Virginia. The percentage of adults 60 and older is growing more rapidly than any other part of the population, and most of them want to stay home as they age. In our first installment, Carol Lofton takes a look at the struggle to age in place in rural America.
So do you walk up the hill instead of taking the stairs?
Yes, because I can't do stairs unless I have something to hold on to.
So you can do this one because there's a railing?
Yeah.
91-year-old Paige Almejandro lives alone in a modest two-story brick home on a quiet street in Barbersville.
How long have you lived in this house?
54 years, I guess it is now.
Paige can barely handle steps these days, which is a big problem, because once you get into her home, you have to climb stairs. The front door opens onto a small landing leading onto a split staircase.
Yeah, there doesn't really seem to be a way to make that easier.
No. You know, you can get
a chairlift?
Lifts for them. But when they're divided like this, you can't. You know, you'd have to get one for both steps, so I just don't go downstairs very much. Mm-hmm. I go when I have to. My laundry room is down there. And usually when my daughter comes over, she'll carry my laundry down for me, and I'll bring it back up. So that's a big help.
But staying in her home is really important to her.
I guess I've always been independent, and I do not want to go live in a nursing home or anything like that until I absolutely have to. Mm-hmm. You lose that when you have to go live in an assisted living or a nursing home. And that would be hard for me.
But is staying home the best option for older adults? Well, we actually don't know. A 2017 review of aging in place literature in the journal Social Work Research found that there isn't actually a lot of analytic research about whether aging in place is better than, say, moving to a retirement community and adapting. Another 2017 review published in the journal Quality of Life Research found the same. Anecdotally, it depends.
Philosophically, it's a question about balancing independence or autonomy and safety.
That's Jenny Prater, a geriatrician at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Prater says often older adults like Paige want to stay home, and their families want to move them to a facility, citing safety concerns.
In general, if a person is able to care for themselves or arrange for an alternative, say family members or neighbors that can come and check on them, or even paid sitter services, especially if they're not required around the clock but only intermittently, those often are better choices than going to a long-term care arrangement.
But she says often whether or not independence outweighs safety comes down to resources.
If someone has enough resources, they can set up essentially a nursing home in their own home.
But most people don't have those kind of resources, especially in Appalachia. There are some state resources to help, but the percentage of West Virginians age 60 and older is growing faster than any other portion of the population. It's a silver tsunami that may already be cresting. And yet, amongst the drug epidemic and foster care crisis, no one is really talking about it. For Appalachia Health News, I'm Kara Lofton.
Appalachia Health News is a project of West Virginia Public Broadcasting with support from Charleston Area Medical Center and Marshall Health. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Our producer is Glennis Board. I'm Teresa Wills.
Hi there, I'm Jim Lang, host of Eclectopia. This week's spotlight is on Kirsch Kalin. Eclectopia Friday at 10, Saturday at 11 on West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
This is West Virginia Public Broadcasting, WVPB Charleston, WVBY Beckley, WVBL Bluefield, WVPW Buchanan, WVWV Huntington, WVEP Martinsburg, WVKM Matewan, WVPM Morgantown, WVPG Parkersburg, WVDS Petersburg, WQAB Philippi, WVWS Webster Springs, WVNP Wheeling, and we're online at wvpublic.org. Support is provided by Beaver Productions, presenting Nora Jones at the Clay Center on June 19th. Tickets now available at theclaycenter.org. Variable cloudiness today, highs in the 30s and 40s. Snow, sleet, and freezing rain tonight, lows in the 20s and 30s. There's a winter storm warning in effect in the east tonight through Thursday. 5 to 8 inches of snow possible. It's 8 o'clock.